evening, everybody, and a very warm welcome to tonight's event, co-organised by LSE Ideas and the International History Department. This evening, Professor Philip Murphy, Director of the Institute of Commonwealth Studies at the University of London, is going to speak about the Empire's New Clothes, the myth of the Commonwealth in the age of Brexit. This was published by Hearst in April of 2018, which coincided with the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, which is also going to be remembered for the fact that it was here that the Queen announced that Prince Charles would become her successor, head of the Commonwealth. So a very nice early 70th birthday present for him. Philip has asked for a more formal event this evening, so what we're going to do, informal, and what we're going to do, it's these trousers, I think I've overdone it. What we're going to do is to have like a 40-minute sort of discussion Q&A, where we chat through the book, and then we'll open it out for discussion. LSE Ideas have asked me to remind you that the event will be recorded, not for training purposes, or possibly, but will be there will be a podcast available. I'll also remind you of that when we start the questions. If I don't remind you, then remind me, and I will. Before we start, however, I would like to stick to some element of formality, and that is a short biographical sketch of tonight's speaker. Professor Philip Murphy was educated at Oxford University, and the book of his PhD, The Conservative Party and the End of Empire, is still the go-to text on that subject over 25 years on. At Reading University, he quickly rose to be a professor of imperial history, after publishing very quickly a fascinating biography of Alan Lennox Boyd, and then I think in record time editing a series in the British Documents of the End of Empire, an encyclopedic collection of documents on one of the most thorny issues of End of Empire in terms of Africa, the Central African Federation. In 2011, he was seconded to become director of the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, where he still is, and he published in 2014 a book on monarchy and the end of empire published by OUP. He's no stranger to controversy either. He very bravely took on some of those historians who argued that there had been a massive cover-up with regard to the violence of the end of empire and the Hanslope archive. And he sort of bravely argued that that was somewhat exaggerated. And far more recently, I think it was on camera, he described tonight's topic, I quote, that's the Commonwealth, as a stuffed parrot glued to a perch.
Dead parrot.
So prepare to have some feathers ruffled, and please join me in welcoming Professor Philip Murphy to LSE. Philip, thank you so much for coming in the hot seat tonight to talk about this topic. Now, why did you decide to write this book?
Sort of to cheer myself up. I mean, it was 2016, which wasn't a good year, and that was before the Brexit referendum had even taken place. And so I mean, it's a horrible thing to say, very sort of workaholic. I was on holiday and my mind was just whirring, and I had to just do a little bit of writing in the morning just to kind of focus my thoughts. And it was immediately after the referendum. And it seems to me, I mean, the Commonwealth had been used on the kind of wilder fringes of the debate. I don't think it was central to the debate at all. But it had been cited as some sort of alternative focus for British foreign policy and British trade. And it struck me how little most of the proponents of those arguments knew about the Commonwealth or had engaged with the Commonwealth. I mean, people like Boris Johnson or Nigel Farage, for whom I suspect the Commonwealth probably represents in its current phase most of the things they disliked the most. And it struck me that there wasn't really a kind of a recent book, an accessible book, on the Commonwealth, discussing it critically. Most of the books have been written by people who are already associated with the organisation and sympathetic towards it. And so partly because we're all now actually participating in this history, which is a rather odd experience for historians. We like history to be somewhere far, far away. And it's really got its claws into us at the moment. So it was a personal book in that respect. And I use the first person quite a lot and talk about my own experience. But it also, I suppose, it reflects my own kind of learning curve. Now, as you mentioned, I'm really sort of an academic historian of End of Empire, who was recruited to be director of the Institute in 2009, not actually knowing a huge amount about the contemporary Commonwealth, but then sort of being asked to sort of pontificate about it and, in a sense, almost represent it. And so in a constructive way, one tries to identify, well, what does it do well? Where can we engage with it? Well, how can the Institute benefit from its relationship with the Commonwealth? And more it seems that one tried to kind of reach out and touch something tangible, and it disappeared into mist. An anecdote sort of illustrating that, which isn't in the book, very early on in my time, we were sort of having a series of events to celebrate our 60th birthday as an institute. It's now the 70th birthday, so 10 years later. And we had the Commonwealth Secretary General, Kamala Sharma, to speak. And this, you know, for someone who was just an academic, historian, it seems rather grand to be associated with this international organization, have the Secretary General coming. And so we recorded the speech, and we said that we would then put the transcript up on the website. So it was recorded, it was transcribed, I had about 16 pages. And I was going through, going to do a kind of a very quick edit. And I sort of, first paragraph, I thought, this is a bit waffly. Maybe we can do without that. Second paragraph. This doesn't quite make sense. Let's move on to the third. And it's like that sort of comedy sketch where someone sort of pulls at a thread on the jumper. And the jumper just eventually kind of dissolves. I had about half a page of text at the end. And in retrospect, this seemed very, almost symbolic of my relationship with the Commonwealth, which moves from sort of mystification to disappointment pretty quickly. But I also thought, you know, that actually there's a kind of a tragicomic book to be written about that. I mean, part of comedy is the sort of the gap between myth and reality. And so I wrote this little piece for my friend's amusement and passed it around, and eventually sent it to Michael Dyer at Hearst, who thought there might be a book there. And the thing that we didn't have, even when the manuscript was ready, was a title. And it came from my wonderful institute manager, Chloe Peters, a graduate of this place, and we were talking about, I think we were talking about research expenses, how we put together kind of a research grant application, and we were sort of being slightly flippant about, you know, the costs of this, and we're saying, well, you know, yeah, we can get it up to this amount, because think of the quality of our work. And Chloe said, yeah, it's like the Empire's, I mean, the Emperor's New Clothes. Stop there. The Empire's New Clothes. That's precisely what I was getting at.
So well, it's very funny, I have to say. But for those people who maybe bought the book a while ago, or will be buying it when you finish, outside later on. Can you, for the benefit also of, say, non-experts, just give us a summary of the main arguments of the book, and possibly also the research that underpins those arguments?
Okay, so just to pluck out a few basic ideas. One of the things that people often see that they don't understand is why did the British government make more of this thing, the Commonwealth? It is, after all, theirs in some sense. It is a British creation. It spans, you know, a quarter of the world's population, 2.4 billion people. Surely this is a wonderful opportunity that the British just keep on missing. And so the first thing, I suppose, in terms of a historical analysis, is the argument that really, although the Commonwealth arises out of empire, the modern Commonwealth, in an institutional sense, really isn't a British creation. In a sense, it developed despite British wishes at almost every point. So from, you know, we're talking now about, you know, the Commonwealth is about to put on a series of events celebrating their 70th birthday. And the Institute of Commonwealth Studies is going to put an event called Why the Commonwealth Isn't 70. That's to say, they're kind of dating it from 1949, to block out all of that nasty empire stuff. But of course, the Commonwealth is a much older institution. But they're dating it from 1949 because, of course, that's when the Commonwealth, agrees to include India as a republic. Britain obviously didn't want India to become a republic. It was a compromise. Britain didn't particularly want to have its first black African member in the 50s. But Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana wanted Ghana to join. British didn't particularly want the Commonwealth to be an association of small states. When in 1960 they were considering whether Cyprus should be allowed to join, they weren't enthusiastic. What's the point in it being sort of propping up these small, not necessarily very viable states? What's good for Britain about that? They weren't happy about South Africa being pushed out in 1961. They certainly weren't happy about the Great Crusade against apartheid in South Africa and against white minority rule in southern Rhodesia. They weren't happy about the creation of the Commonwealth Secretariat. That was an idea that came from a number of developing world countries. They weren't happy about the creation of the Commonwealth's main development arm, the CFTC, Commonwealth Fund on Technical Cooperation. In fact, the only time they really get proactively involved in trying to shape the organization is in the early 90s under John Major, and for reasons that we'll explain, that doesn't go very far, or doesn't seem to kind of deliver the goods, and then Blair comes on the scene and completely has zero interest in the organization. So that's, maybe one can understand Britain's ambivalent relationship with the Commonwealth. One understands that it's not really in its modern form a British creation. So the next thing is, why do 53 members continue to belong to it? Yeah. And why do some, you know, smaller states want to, you know, new states want to join it? Because often the Commonwealth, says, well, if it's such a mess, why does, you know, Burundi want to join? Why does Southern Cameroon want to join? Well, if I was the president of Burundi, I'd want to join. I mean, the benefits are marginal, but it means that if there's a coup against you, someone gives a damn in London. It's part of your, it's a kind of a kite mark of respectability, which is maybe a sort of soft power benefit. But it's part of your, it buttresses your legitimacy as a state to belong to any sort of international organization like that. But when you look at the kind of the factors that have bound the Commonwealth together in the past, I think they're depreciating assets. And you can go through them, first education. I mean, so many of the original leaders of the Commonwealth, independence leaders, shared a sort of British education, either places like this, or Oxbridge, or at least went to British-style schools. And I remember part of the kind of the data that I was able to draw on was from our really major research project at the Institute over recent years, the so-called Commonwealth Oral History Project. We got a major grant from the British, the HRC, to carry out about 80, we did 80 interviews in the end around with leaders of Commonwealth states, former foreign ministers, prime ministers, heads of the Commonwealth organizations. It was an elite project, but with a very practical question. Why does the Commonwealth continue to matter? Does it matter to you? Was it useful to you? And most of the interviews were done by my colleague Sue Anslow. I did one or two in India, and a really lovely interview with K. Shankar Bajpayee, who is a very distinguished Indian diplomat, former secretary at the Ministry of External Affairs, whose father was the first secretary for the foreign ministry under Nehru, who'd also had this English education. And Bajpayee said, yes, for my father. He said the Commonwealth represented, he said, the expression of Enlightenment values. You know, although independence leaders might have sort of learned from that tradition to value independence and basically found, you know, to get rid of the British, something about that tradition still mattered, and the Commonwealth seemed to embody it. I mean, those educational links are no longer so important in terms of providing a common frame of reference for Commonwealth leaders today, obviously. You've got a kind of inner circle, of course. This is a sort of the dirty secret of the Commonwealth. You have an inner Commonwealth and outer Commonwealth. Inner Commonwealth of Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the so-called, you know, particularly important in terms of defense, security, the Five Eyes partners. But even then, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, particularly Australia and New Zealand, over the last 40 years, think far more in terms of their regional identity than their identity with the so-called, you know, mother country. You're seeing a sort of a change there. The significance of the Commonwealth during the Cold War, I think, can't be underestimated. It was a way of keeping communications going and, if possible, weaning newly independent states away from Soviet influence. Again, when the Cold War ends, that creates a bit of an identity problem for the Commonwealth. Likewise, the Great Crusade against South Africa. This is a great sort of, you know, the triumph and tragedy of the Commonwealth insofar as it helps to end apartheid. Once apartheid is gone, it loses its unifying factor and struggles to find a clear central identity. It's often seen as a kind of a vehicle for the interests of small states, the Commonwealth. But again, there are lots of new organizations that have grown up in the last 50 years which represent those kinds of regional interests. So starting from the Organization of American States, 1948, CARICOM, ECOWAS for the Caribbean, West Africa in the 1970s, the Asian Association for Regional Cooperation in the 80s, Association of Small Island States in 1990. So again, perhaps the Commonwealth is losing some of its utility with the increasing importance of regional groupings, which can work far more effectively and cohesively. So one is almost left with what Bajpayee said to me. I said in the end, well, the end of the interview, well, what's the Commonwealth's greatest achievement? And he said that it's still there. And that's, again, it's the kind of the triumph and the tragedy. And he said, you know, in this wonderful way, if you're a member of a club, why leave it? And there's a kind of inertia that is holding things together. And I suppose, finally, just in terms of sort of roundup of ideas, What's holding it together? What's holding it together is kind of a series of civil society organisations, mostly based in London, mostly rather impoverished, mostly ageing, losing their membership, losing their financial base, but still almost sometimes rather sect-like in their belief in this organisation, that it will somehow rise again, phoenix-like, from the ashes. The other prop, of course, in London is the Palace, which it's another factor about the British not really being in control of the Commonwealth. We could say, will the Commonwealth survive in 20, 30 years? Well, as a term of art, it will. It's not one thing. It's not the Secretariat. As a group of states with a single monarch, it will survive. And although leaders like Portia Simpson Miller in Jamaica, you know, who, when she took office in 2012, said time for republic, ending the monarchy, ending appeals to the Privy Council. What has she done? Nothing. It's far more difficult to get those sorts of pieces of legislation through. So for all the rhetoric, I don't see those links disappearing very quickly. In Canada, for example, it's virtually impossible to get rid of the monarchy under the 1982 constitution. But I think more profoundly, the monarchy has identified the Commonwealth as being under threat, and members of the royal family have sort of piled in. So one's just seen Meghan becoming patron of the Association of Commonwealth Universities. Camilla became deputy patron of the Royal Commonwealth Society last year. Charles has just been confirmed as the next head of the Commonwealth, etc., etc. But in a broader sense, what the Queen has done throughout her reign is to present the Commonwealth as some sort of unquestionable good which is above politics. She's never done that for Europe. Europe hasn't been incorporated in the grand narrative of British identity, but the Commonwealth has. And I think it's a very important thing that she's done. Finally, soft power. I have a little joke at the expense of a book by David Howell, Lord Howell of Guildford, who was actually, to be fair to him, one of the more thoughtful Commonwealth supporters in the House of Lords. And he published a book in 2013 called Old Links, New Ties, Power and Persuasion in the Age of Networks, which is really arguing that the Commonwealth is the ultimate soft power vehicle. Sort of incorporates Joseph Nye. Joseph Nye writes a nice little recommendation for the back cover. And Howell is saying, you know, the old days of kind of American hegemony are over. You know, Iraq was a disaster. It's all about soft power now. The Commonwealth is the ultimate soft power vehicle. I say in the book, you know, bells rang out across London. The Commonwealth true believers finally had the sacred text that they'd always lacked. This idea, that's why we believe in it so firmly, because it's soft power. And there are three chapters which really sort of, I suppose, question that. One on, which is called Guilt, which is about debates around the legacy of empire. And I think, you know, when you and I started as graduate students writing about decolonization, I think there was a feeling that even then, and certainly now, you know, the British Empire would just be regarded as something like the Crimean War and the Napoleonic Wars. It would be pure history. We would just write about it, you know, as though it was a kind of distant past, and we would try and understand it, we would explain it, but it wouldn't come with these morally loaded questions about was it a good thing or a bad thing? Did we do a good job? You know, that generation would die out. But ironically, it's almost become more like that as we move towards a kind of a politics of symbolism and identity politics. Empires are kind of the great original sin of Britain, the idea that empire, you know, that the iniquities of empire have been covered up. So it's very much part of the kind of culture wars in Britain and elsewhere, we've seen things like calls for compensation, roads must fall, etc., etc. The great elephant in the room for the Commonwealth, and the thing that they, you know, they're in utter denial about, is that they are a remnant of empire. You know, that is what actually unites most of their members. So they were former members of the British Empire. So is it useful as a soft power vehicle, have a soft power vehicle that reminds people of empire, or even suggests that the British people are terminally empire-minded and imperial nostalgics? And many diplomats, particularly diplomats who've dealt with India, would say actually that it's not very helpful in that regard. And, you know, I found that myself. You know, when people ask me at a party, what do you do? I say I'm director of the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. But I'm not an imperialist. I'm really not. And you know, when I was offered the job 10 years ago, all my friends, oh, it's Karen at the Khyber, but Philip, you're having tea with the Queen. It will be gin tonics on the veranda. You know, that was just my mum. And I think people outside the Commonwealth bubble sometimes don't recognize the slightly jaundiced way that a lot of the rest of the world sees the Commonwealth. So soft power, peddling, you know, the idea of the Commonwealth as a means of projecting values across the world of good governance, democracy, the rule of law. Again, that it hasn't worked so well from a British government perspective, again, because the British government can only put so much pressure on a country before it turns around and says you're acting like a neo-imperialist. Or, you know, don't condemn us for our views on gay rights because we're just enforcing laws that you put in place in the first place. The Commonwealth becomes a bit of a double-edged sword. And you don't, you know, if you think that it's about establishing a framework of values, you've got to be aware of the symbolism. And it's not good if you're doing that to have as your chair in office, as happened in 2013, someone who is regarded in many places in the world as a major war criminal, Mahinda Rajapaksa, president of Sri Lanka. And there's a whole chapter on the kind of slow motion car crash under which the Rajapaksa suddenly managed to become, to you know, host the organization, take it over in a sense. And that's the other danger of a sort of a moribund organization, which is apparently fairly harmless, that it can be sort of vulnerable to institutional capture and my God, Sri Lanka showed you how you could use the Commonwealth as a soft power vehicle. And, you know, got Bell Pottinger involved in the process as well. So those are the sorts of ideas that I'm sort of tossing around.
Thank you, Philip. On some of those ideas and bursting the bubble, can I just remind you of some of the ways in which you described your arguments in the book for a number of reasons. You described the Commonwealth, quote, the equivalent of a homeopathic remedy offered by charlatans, quacks, throughout the ages, essentially as offering something for nothing.
Yeah.
Quote, a stagnant organisation with a weak leadership but an equally weak sense of ownership amongst its members, vulnerable to captive, a contributing factor to Britain's greatest foreign policy disaster ever. I'll continue. An old comfort blanket that has become increasingly toxic, and I will continue. a Byzantine and slightly dysfunctional network, and I will continue again, has held together by inertia. And last, but by no means least, my personal favourite, hang on to your hats, for Britain's administrative elite, the Commonwealth is a bit like a grandfather clock that's been in the family for generations. It hasn't told the right time for decades, but no one has the heart to take it to the tip. Do you think you held back a bit? And also, how come you're still in a job? In a sense, I want to know, what has the response, you know, been to this incendiary device?
It's been an interesting response. My academic colleagues have been very kind in their reviews. Got some nice reviews. A lot of people hate the book, particularly from the sort of Commonwealth community, former figures from the Secretariat.
Have you been trolled?
They don't do trolling. Social media. It's letters directly to the Vice Chancellor demanding my sacking, you know. It's from and copied into Princess Anne, literally in one case.
That is
but I mean, if you've got to make enemies in the world, might as well be with the Commonwealth rather than, say, the Russian mafia or something like that. You know, your life is not really good. You know, they haven't shown great potential for putting pressure on states or people or, you know, anything really. I found it was, you know, I mean, by nature, as those who know me like you will be able to tell anyone, I'm very well behaved, I'm a very good boy, I don't like getting into trouble. And it really was a kind of the book is a sort of about that process of trying, you know, arriving 10 years ago, thinking how can you establish links with this organization, how can you try and make it work, exploit the good parts about it. And gradually being disillusioned. And the structure of the book, I suppose, reflects that. I mean, there's opening chapters looking at the structure. But then the chapter on values is really about the 2011 CHOGM, which is the first Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Perth, which was the first one I went to. And seeing this attempt to create a kind of, they'd commissioned this major report on reform by a so-called eminent persons group. And the Secretariat really completely mishandled the whole thing. And the kind of key proposal was that there should be a Commonwealth Charter, but backed up by a Commissioner for Human Rights, Democracy and the Rule of Law to actually give it some teeth. So what, of course, they did was to ditch the Commissioner but keep the Charter. And as I say, you know, Peter Cook's line about it being an only twin. It stands there as, you know, completely pointless and toothless. And the whole thing was a complete farce. You know, you had the chapter on the Sri Lanka debacle, which I've talked about before. When the Commonwealth throws credibility to the wind, and it was in 2013 I made that sort of dead parrot remark, which really got me into trouble because it was in the Times. But it was sheer anger, really. That you know, you watch this, and then finally Brexit, and seeing the Commonwealth being invoked by, you know, these kind of charlatans. And I, you know, the one thing that sort of slightly annoyed me in terms of the reaction, there was a piece which appeared, and it was by a sort of former chair of the sort of round table group, and it appeared on the University of Exeter Imperial History blog site. I say at the end, and I say it very, I phrase it very carefully. I say that, you know, the reality of the Commonwealth should give us very little to fear. But I say the main danger to the UK, as was amply demonstrated in the 2016 EU referendum, is the myth of the Commonwealth. It is increasingly being commandeered by a grim collection of charlatans, chancers, and outright villains. And you can think about who I meant by that. But I didn't say that the Commonwealth itself was. The Commonwealth, in many cases, is made up by very well-meaning people who support it for very good reasons. It's more about the kind of that mythology of the Commonwealth and that how dangerous it is in the British national psychology. And you know, that's what the book is really getting at. And if as a result the Commonwealth thinks a little bit more carefully about what it does. That's good, but it's not really the main focus of the book.
Well, we'll come on to Brexit in a moment and the Commonwealth. Because there is an argument, isn't there, that this response to Brexit has meant that the Commonwealth has been attacked and it's an easy target. You do, in your book, recognise, as you've already laid out to a degree, that it has done a lot of good things. Do you think there's a danger that some of those get lost? I mean, for example, Nazarene Zahari Radcliffe, who's currently held hostage by the Iranian government, I mean, she would love an organisation, surely, to have some soft power, like the Commonwealth Association of Journalists. Do you think there is a danger that some of the good that it does is being lost sight of, and it's very easy to make fun of it? I mean, I myself, there was the Commonwealth Queen's Canopy Association. That's what I read. It was actually canopy, which is about trees. Is there a danger that we can poke fun of it, have a laugh at it too easily?
I think that, in the light of what this country is going through at the moment, it needs someone to really throw light on the Commonwealth and to be deeply critical of it. Because I think it's not so much any specific argument about what it does or what it fails. It's about a kind of magical thinking, which one sees in the extreme Brexiteers. A kind of you just hold a revolution, and suddenly everything will be all right. We'll get by. We're a special sort of people. The idea around the Commonwealth is that somehow, almost magically, it will become useful again. Irrespective of what its budget is, how it's organized, what it does, its day will come. And I think one really has to attack that. And I think that's where the anger comes from. If you think about it very broadly, it is a good thing that, we deal with 52 other states in the world through high commissioners rather than ambassadors, with the idea that they are in some sense friends rather than foreigners. And it's just a shame that we didn't extend that system, I think, to members of the European Union. Again, it sort of suggests that they are in a special category of non-foreigners, which, is the Commonwealth. So it's useful in that sense. Potentially those voluntarist networks are useful, but they're very, very weak, they're very underfunded. But there are some that are worth preserving. I mean, the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association. I mean, even if the Secretariat, if one decided to, that the Secretariat, which has only been going since 1965, was an experiment which had outlived its usefulness. One could see an option being simply to pour a lot of that money into things like the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, which could take over responsibility for election monitoring, could keep those links open to countries which in many respects share, or their political system has a sort of family resemblance to the Westminster model. And that is a kind of a useful form of soft power diplomacy. Perhaps the universities as well. But the problem with the Commonwealth at the moment is it tries to touch all the bases, and achieves very little in any area as a result.
Yes, I get from your overall critique from your chapters that you remain profoundly and impressed. You became more and impressed as you did the research. And I think what's very useful for students in this book is that you detail sort of four main areas of criticism. First of all, that the Commonwealth has showed itself not fit for purpose. Mm-hmm. particularly since the 1990s with its shared values push. Secondly, it's very vulnerable to being taken over by more unscrupulous leaders. And thirdly, which is, it was a fascinating chapter on the guilt section, was that it has failed to provide leadership and a forum for a mature debate in this country about Britain's imperial past and its legacy. And that, you say, has had profound consequences for the way in which we discuss that now. And it's sort of become very toxic. And then finally, you know, most urgently, and we'll talk about this a bit more, I'm sure, is the way in which the myth of the Commonwealth has been hijacked and peddled by Eurosceptics. And you have evidence in the book of Eurosceptics, UKIP, so on and so forth, mobilising support for Brexit based on this vision of the Commonwealth. But what about that third point, then, that it's failed to provide leadership and a forum for a mature debate about Britain's imperial past and its legacy? Do you really think that an institute that, as you say, is a child, bastard child of imperialism, that it could do that?
Well, I'm thinking of ways in which it could be, that network could be useful. As I say, there was this attempt from the 90s to say the Commonwealth is united by shared values. In a sense, it isn't, by any serious measure. What is interesting about the Commonwealth is that it brings together very, very different states from different parts of the world with different traditions, different religions, different cultures. But what almost all of them have involved, except a sort of one or two, Mozambique, Rwanda, is that they were formerly part of the British Empire. And as I said, we seem to find it very difficult, almost increasingly difficult, to have a serious debate about the legacy of empire in the UK. The Commonwealth provides a forum in which, you know, there is the potential for that. What it means for them, how we can move on, how we can reshape the relationship. But it's something the Commonwealth is almost determined not to do, because it wants to, the idea of shared values is so important because history becomes irrelevant. It's almost an accident that these countries are all formerly part of the British Empire. But it's not, it's actually that historical legacy is the thing that you know, is the common factor. But it's the last thing most parts of the Commonwealth actually want to talk about. And indeed, you know, the chapter starts with this little quote from Danny Siskandaraja, who was then director of the Royal Commonwealth Society, giving evidence to the Foreign Affairs Committee on the Future of the Commonwealth, saying, "The last place I would like the Commonwealth to be taught is in history lessons." Well, that's precisely where I think the Commonwealth should be taught.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
So from that argument then, what you argue is that history has become overly politicised as a result of the Commonwealth as an organisation not being willing to engage and set up debates. That I think you quote, is it David Streiff? It's all about memory, basically, not about history anymore. And also, in the climate of not being confident about the future, the past then fills into the past is fought over in a political way because there is no concept of a future of moving on. So the Commonwealth is not giving an ability to move on. It's like a cannibalistic approach.
I wasn't really blaming the Commonwealth for that, but I mean, I think it's an interesting phenomenon. I think one of the things that although the Commonwealth is often seen as this kind of relic of empires, this sort of bit of British imperial nostalgia, the people who adhered to it in the 60s and 70s really often had quite a radical vision. I mean, there was a sense that those states were about to take off, that Africa was going to be transformed, that Asia was going to be transformed. There was a sort of a bright new dawn ahead. And the Commonwealth could be a kind of a vehicle for this, for a new kind of global radical politics, a world away from, you know, sort of old imperial ideology. And I suppose, you know, particularly by the time you get to 1990, the Cold War is over, and with it the ability for smaller developing states maybe to play off one side against the other. You've got the debt crisis. You've seen them being squeezed by international institutions like the World Bank to democratize, to introduce free markets. That the great new dawn hasn't really happened. And you could see, in a sense, these arguments about colonialism as an attempt to turn the argument back on the West and say, look, we didn't do all that well, but we started from such a lousy base because of what you left us with. And as you see the kind of the, in more recent years, I suppose, the kind of old left being transformed by a kind of a new left of intersectionality, identity politics, if that's not too much of a kind of caricature, then again, empire takes on this important role in the same way that I suppose, you know, slavery does in North America for, you know, a sort of ideology of black empowerment. So I think that, you know, that for all of those reasons, I think the Commonwealth is more vulnerable to those sorts of accusations of being part of a kind of movement of imperial nostalgia than, say, it was in the 60s and 70s, when there really was a kind of a sense of a radical trajectory there.
Thank you. Just finally, can I just press you on a couple of aspects related to my own research and interest?
Yeah.
How can we get the diaspora, you know, the British
yeah.
Commonwealth diaspora, much more into research like this? You have
yeah.
this very interesting
yeah.
quote, the 10% yeah. of Indian people think the head of the Commonwealth is Kofi Annan, and a quarter of Jamaicans think it was thinks it's
yeah.
Barack
yeah.
Obama. Those figures, though, are very yeah. positive figures,
yeah.
aren't they? So that shows a positive association of the Commonwealth, even if, you know, it's not it's not the Queen.
Yeah.
But it's those kinds of questions and that kind of information, I think, would be so helpful to you add to a study that can,
mm-hmm.
so it's less top-down
yeah, yeah,
and more
yeah.
political,
yeah.
you know, about the British, you know, black in particular, you know, diaspora
yeah.
and
yeah,
the Commonwealth.
Yeah, I think what we were very clear when we did the Commonwealth Oral History Project that it was a sort of policy-making piece of research. But lots of people have said, look, there is a different Commonwealth, there's the Commonwealth diaspora, what about an oral history project for that? And it's something that we're thinking about at the moment, particularly looking at the kind of the issues around the Windrush generation and personal experience of people who found their sort of citizenship and their right to abode questioned, how that developed over time. I mean, of course, people will say, you know, the Commonwealth may be moribund, but look at the boost that it gave to the Windrush Generation campaign in April. That, you know, Theresa May, against her will, was forced to meet with Caribbean leaders and really explain herself over this, you know, disgraceful treatment. Now, I think that was as much that, you know, it that was due to some very astute lobbying by a number of the High Commissioners in London, the Caribbean High Commissioners, using the fact that the world press were going to be in town, international leaders were going to be in town, and really kind of, if you like, hijacking the event, but in a very positive sense. I suspect that if those leaders had sort of tried to do it if those high commissioners tried to do it in a more formal way and said, can the Commonwealth help with the Windrush generation, they wouldn't have touched it with a barge pole, the Commonwealth Secretary, because they would have regarded it as too political. So in a way, that's the trick we played with my book. I said to Hearst, if it comes out in April 2018, there'll be lots of international reporters in town. There won't be any stories. We'll get some publicity. And it worked. And certainly the conference itself didn't generate any major stories except Prince Charles being confirmed as the next head. But the other one, the completely unexpected one, was Windrush. The problem is that, the Commonwealth heads of government meetings, they happen every 2 years, and each one during my time, the story has been about process. In 2011, it was about screwing up the eminent person group report on reform. 2013, it was about the disgrace of it being in Sri Lanka in the first place. 2015, it was about selecting a new Secretary General, Baroness Scotland. And 2018, it was about Charles. So it's all about process rather than results. And the can gets kicked down the road for another 2 years.
So if it's about high politics, policy, elites, is there an argument we can take further then, that if we take your quote about greedy, gullible, insecure people peddling ideas, an outrageous comic parable, we're not just talking about the Commonwealth here, we're talking about the House of Lords, we're talking about the royal family. You've got a number of examples in your book at key moments when it's the House of Lords who are lobbying or are the glue that makes keeps this show on the road. So have we got sort of one, disastrous, corrupt institution that is undermining, meritocracy, propping up the other, and that, this is what gives them their strength, and that we need to think about tackling a whole set of institutions that, have a lot to do with the fact that we live in the most unequal society in the world, not just a Commonwealth that is dysfunctional.
I think the situation we're in right now, over Brexit, it's like a kind of national nervous breakdown. And if you have a nervous breakdown, the good thing to do is to take some time out and think about everything, really. And there are so many things one could focus on in our attempt to recover from our national nervous breakdown. And so many things that we thought we could deal with, but actually have helped to lead us to this point. And, one of the things that I'm sort of slightly uncomfortable with is this idea of, some kind of national imperial nostalgia. I'm not sure how functional, how useful that is. I'm not sure how useful it is to sort of pathologize a population in that way if you can't really prove those things very well. But certainly within what you would call the establishment, and certainly the higher echelons and the monarchy in particular, there has been preserved this kind of myth of the Commonwealth. And if it hadn't been for the palace, successive British governments might have moved away from the institution before now. Now you could say that's an achievement of the Queen or a fairly malign influence of the British monarchy. It's up to you.
Well, let's hear some views from the audience. One of the reviewers of your book, MP Kwasi Kwarteng, says that this book will cause you either to nod vigorously or sigh in exasperated disagreement. So I hope we have more nods, more than nods and sighs from the audience. Let's take a couple of questions on this point. So jump in the front here.
Thank you for the talk. Last year I worked in the University of Ghana as a research assistant. And I was helping write a paper about the Commonwealth and how Ghanaians viewed it. And the research we found was that many Ghanaians like being part of the Commonwealth, but apart from the Commonwealth scholarships, they have no idea what it does. Mm. And realistically, the average Commonwealth citizen is living in dire poverty. Mm. It's a reality.
Yeah.
And the other question I want to ask is quick, is just how is it that if the Commonwealth is such this good cohesive family as it's portrayed to be, its members have gone to war with each other, and two of the nations have pointed nuclear weapons at each other.
Mm.
And it doesn't seem that it's able to mediate that at all.
Yeah. Okay.
Good questions.
Do you want to take a number, or should I answer those?
Okay, answer, go for it.
There aren't that many examples of Commonwealth countries going to war with each other. It can be a useful network to resolve conflict if conflicts exist. Certainly, if you think about why the Commonwealth survived, if you look at the cabinet records for the 1970s, 1980s, Rhodesia, South Africa are never off the agenda. And the Commonwealth is part of the solution because its member states are predominant in that region. It can play a useful role. It could play a useful role in conflict resolution. I don't think it's a kind of... I mean, there's maybe a myth that for an international organization to be effective, it needs to be understood and supported at a popular level. Maybe it does or it doesn't. And that's involved, you know, it's led to the Commonwealth doing a lot of kind of public outreach and you know, like a lot of organizations that are sort of aging, well, they sort of fetishizes youth engagement and that sort of thing. I sometimes say that, you know, actually if the Commonwealth met in complete secret every 2 years on a kind of a distant Pacific island, and there were no reporters allowed, and you know the leaders went in by helicopter, you would have, you know, hundreds of thousands of Californian computer bloggers telling you that the Commonwealth was the secret ruler of the world. And, you know, young people would be, their imaginations would be hugely engaged by that. So, I mean, scholarships are clearly very important, but whether it's necessary for an organization to be effective, it ultimately, you know, it has functioned in the past as an elite organization for high-level policymakers. But even at that level, it doesn't seem to function very well anymore.
Got lots of hands up here, so let's have three questions. Thank you.
My question's in two parts. So I grew up in Australia, and so thank you, that was very interesting hearing about how Britain sort of perceives the Commonwealth. I find that fascinating. I'm quite concerned about this idea of this inner Commonwealth of, you know, particularly, I think, former, I guess, white colonies, and that role they might play in Brexit, and whether that is pertaining also to a more, I guess, a racialized understanding of a throwback to empire. So yeah. I mentioned that, but also having recently been in Australia and reading the Australian news quite regularly, Brexit isn't really on, like, the minds of the Australian people, in the sense that, you know, there's about to be an election, it's not like anyone's talking about these trade deals, really. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on how, I guess, the countries that a lot of Brexiteers are relying on to do these trade agreements or political agreements, whatever they're going to look like, what their thoughts are on Brexit, because the general understanding I'm having from Australia is we don't want to get involved in that.
Yeah.
And I'm just interested if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, thank you.
Hello. My question is about the kind of balance of power between the Commonwealth and Britain, because I think I kind of agree with you that what's preventing the Commonwealth from kind of moving on or realizing it's like new dawn is Britain's influence in it, and the fact that that's kind of not been broken since its imperial rule.
Yeah.
But could, I mean, Brexit seems to be about to change that or changing that already. Mm. I mean, like, what Professor Lewis is saying about the misconception of who actually is head of the Commonwealth suggests that's happened long, long ago. But my question is basically, do you think Brexit is going to mean that Britain needs the Commonwealth more than the Commonwealth needs it? And, you know, this kind of emissary, we're sending out our royals into the Commonwealth to reassert their influence in a slightly kind of desperate, dying breath attempt to reassert that we are head of the Commonwealth, when in fact we're kind of begging them to be friends with us.
Sorry, we're dominating the what you call the question and answer, this small bit group. So, nevertheless, what I was, I mean, in the context of Brexit, has Commonwealth any economic use?
Okay, taking the third question first, because I think it also relates to the first questions. As I said, the Commonwealth featured, I'm sure it wasn't a decisive factor in the referendum itself, And most of the polling that's been done suggests that very few people voted for Brexit because they believed the country would be better off. But there was some kind of recycling of propaganda which had been generated by the Commonwealth Secretariat and the Commonwealth Business Council, suggesting that there were huge untapped economic potentials within the Commonwealth. I mean, this is, and the book sort of traces that from, you can see a kind of a movement from the mid-1990s, when people who support the Commonwealth start to talk about it in those terms. And they kind of realize that it's the one thing that actually catches the government's attention. So there's an article about it around table by an Australian scholar, Catherine West, from 1994. It's taken up by the Foreign Affairs Committee's investigation into the Commonwealth in the mid-90s. It's something that Robin Cook gets hold of in the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Edinburgh in 1997. When he's sort of trying to, you know, Blair is not interested in the Commonwealth at all, but Robin Cook thinks, okay, this is the one thing that a new Labour government can really engage with the Commonwealth over, its untapped, you know, business potential. And you get this kind of propaganda suggesting, you know, there are all these sort of figures which keep on being trotted out. You know, Commonwealth countries are 20% more likely to trade with each other than if they weren't members of the Commonwealth. Business costs are 19% lower. Things are actually, in practice, based on very flaky research and very flaky figures. But it, you know, for Commonwealth supporters, it was clearly an important way of trying to engage government. And I think the danger is that, you know, that rhetoric was taken up by groups like UKIP. I mean, 2010, UKIP went into the election promising to create a Commonwealth free trade area of all things. So they dropped that by 2015 because it's such a ludicrous idea. But you still see newspaper articles written by UKIP politicians, by Tory Brexiteers. And after the referendum, suddenly even people who'd sort of sat on the fence, like David Howell, were saying, now we can engage with the Commonwealth. There are huge business opportunities that Brexit will allow us to engage. And it's very difficult to see what those opportunities are. I mean, the fact that we're talking about, you know, we talk about the potential for Canada Plus. Canada already has negotiated this deal with the EU, which we will be opting out of when we leave the EU. I mean, there are agreements in place or in being negotiated with about 90% of Commonwealth countries and the EU, which we currently participate in, or will participate in. Those will all have to be renegotiated. Although Australia and New Zealand are not part of those, they make up less than 2% of Britain's overall trade, compared with 44% in the EU. And, you know, you sort of see figures that if there's a sort of 5% loss of trade with the EU, one would have to increase trade with the Commonwealth by about 25% to even compensate for that. And there is no likely prospect of that happening. On the issue of the Anglosphere, that it's really interesting. I mean, what you started to see since really over the last 5 or 10 years were people starting to talk about, not the Commonwealth, but our Commonwealth friends in New Zealand, Australia, and Canada. So for a lot of the kind of, you know, a lot of sort of UKIPers whose patron saint is, you know, Margaret Thatcher and Enoch Powell, they were not great fans of the Commonwealth. It's associated with multiracialism, with immigration. So there's almost an attempt over the last, and you had like Boris Johnson's idea floated in 2012-13 of a mobility zone between Britain and New Zealand and Australia. So there's kind of an attempt to, by the sort of the Eurosceptic right, to recreate a sort of white commonwealth. And, you know, there's a quite interesting book by Michael Kenny,
Nick Pierce,
on the Angst Fair, talking about, yeah, which came out at almost exactly the same time as my book.
Sounds good.
Well, it does very, it looks at different things. It looks very specifically at the idea of the Anglosphere and how it's developed over time. And it's been very interesting to see that notion kind of rediscovered in the context of Brexit.
Then we have some other questions down here. Gentleman here, and there's two questions over there. It's a gentleman here.
Thank you for your discussion. Do you think that the Commonwealth would be a more consequential and dynamic institution or organisation if the UK left? I mean, it's not going to, but do you think it would allow countries to take more ownership of the organisation and perhaps, I guess, just make you more use of it in that sense without the baggage that the UK has?
Yeah, I mean, it's all right.
Gentleman here, please. And there was also a gentleman in the corner there.
Hello, Professor Murray. I want to explore a bit on the concept of Commonwealth citizenship. Mm-hmm. At the moment, it is a concept, you know, defined in British law. But I believe, is there a way to revitalize or put more, you know, into this concept to make it more inclusive, or maybe even to facilitate the, you know, building of friendship? And I mean, is this something that we can use this as a way to put more value and add more, you know, the Commonwealth citizenship, this concept? You have to have your book talk about this.
Okay.
Hi. The gentleman here asked the question I was going to ask, but do you get a sense that this renewed nostalgia for the Commonwealth among Brexiteers is not only bad for the UK, but possibly bad for the Commonwealth as well? It seems to me sometimes that Britain's attitude to the Commonwealth is a bit like a bad boyfriend. It lost interest in the Commonwealth to a certain extent when it joined the EU, and the Commonwealth adapted to that. But now it's back, and it's going to have to adapt to Britain's renewed interest.
We've got some competition here with these one-liners.
Can I just take that last one? It's such a lovely idea. It's almost like, I mean, just to play with that analogy a little bit. It's almost like sort of, you know, texting an ex out of the blue and saying, I've changed my mind, you know. I mean, can't we be together again? And I think you go, you know, you're likely to be in prison for stalking eventually. And this is a sort of, I mean, this is the great Brexiteer fantasy that we, you know, suddenly, you know, the prodigal mother comes back saying, I love my children after all, I want to embrace you, and wonders why everyone sort of runs away screaming in the opposite direction. Absolutely. And if the UK left, I mean, this has been something that people have played with for a long time, the idea, well, not if the UK left, because in a sense it can't. So long as, you know, certainly so long as the monarchy is there, it is one of 16 Commonwealth realms, unless it abolishes the monarchy, it's going to be joined to those, you know, at least a dozen other countries in some way. The question then becomes, if Britain doesn't provide the focal point, who does? I know there was an essay which won some sort of prize in Round Table about 10 years ago, or maybe more, saying India should take control of the Commonwealth, to take leadership of the Commonwealth. It is, after all, the most populous Commonwealth state. You know, most Commonwealth citizens live in the Indian subcontinent. India has no interest in the Commonwealth at all. And that's always been the sort of, that's always been the vacuum at the heart. India remaining in the Commonwealth in 1949 meant that it became essentially a third world based organization in terms of its population. But no, it was absolutely clear from the beginning. It was not going to bind India's hands in any respect. You know, and that's the problem with the Commonwealth. The forces creating it have been entirely centrifugal. No one is prepared to be bound by a sort of central decision-making process in the way that they are in any sort of serious organization. So, you know, if Britain is not sort of acting as focal point, it's difficult to know who would or where it would be. Commonwealth citizenship, you know, it's interesting, Commonwealth citizenship, that the Royal Commonwealth Society keeps on throwing out these slightly kind of odd ideas about how the Commonwealth should be revived. And they had this idea there should be a kind of we should again have a Commonwealth queue at British immigration, as though that would make people feel better, you know. And I think, well, you know, there could be, you know, that's great. There could be a kind of professors of Commonwealth history queue at immigration. But the only thing I'd be interested in, does it move quicker than the other queues? The fact is that Commonwealth citizenship doesn't mean anything anymore, hasn't done, certainly since, you know, the 1981 Commonwealth Immigrants Act. Although, you know, it's such an interesting story, and it tells you a lot about, again, that sort of the British grand narrative, the British psyche, that it's only in 1981 that you actually have a separate British citizenship created. The inhabitants of Britain were previously classified as, you know, members of the UK and colonies. But in practice, you know, from 1962 onwards, that idea of the open door of, of some sort of broader citizenship or subjecthood has meant increasingly little, and by the early 80s it meant nothing. And you're never going to revive that, and certainly not in the context of Brexit, where immigration seems to have been one of the levers that Leave pulled most vigorously and ruthlessly.
Any more questions? A gentleman at the back there. Any more?
Hello, Professor Murphy. Thank you so much for the talk. It gave some interesting ideas to think about, please. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the underlying idea of the talk that I understood, the way I understood, was we need to improve the Commonwealth. It should exist. That was the assumption that went all through the talk. And correct me if I'm wrong. And why I'm a little confused about that is basically because of 2 points. One, it started at a time where the era was very different from what it is now. Being a lawyer who's trained both in India and here, people say it's a common law country, but the legal system in India and the UK are quite different. And I'm just taking it as an anecdote to sort of make a point that things are very different. So that one.
Yeah.
And two, it has a certain amount of toxic baggage that we mentioned in the, while talking about Brexit. Now, because of these two factors, do you think we really need the Commonwealth?
No. But by the same token, you don't abolish the Commonwealth just by abolishing one part of it. So as I say, the Secretariat has existed only since 1965. It was an attempt to turn the Commonwealth into a sort of conventional international organisation, with a central body, with a Secretary General. You could abolish that. In practice, it's dying. It's dying by slow degrees. Member states are not prepared to say it should go, but they're voting with their wallets. In the figures, you know, there's been a report, a biannual report published by the Commonwealth recently, the financial figures are stark. Only about 5 years ago, the Commonwealth's budget overall was just over 50 million, which is tiny by international organisation standards. But this financial year, it looks as though it will be about 32. That's almost entirely due to member states and the big donors like Britain, Canada, Australia, cutting back on discretionary payments to the development arm, the Commonwealth Fund for Technical Cooperation. So again, if you look at how the funding was formed about 5 years ago, you see it's about, it's about 63%, 63% discretionary, and 37% mandatory. Now it's the opposite. It's about 37% discretionary, but 63% mandatory. Basically, it's being starved of funds because countries have no faith in its ability to deliver. And that's how it's, I think it's just going to be run into the ground. But even if there was decision taken that it's outlived its lifetime, you would still probably use the Commonwealth as a term of art to describe certain countries that, used to belong to the British Empire, where English is widely spoken, where there are, even though they might seem dissimilar, there are certain resemblances in the kind of parliamentary legal systems, the use of the common law. There is that link through the crown to certain countries. So it's not going to disappear overnight. And there may be areas, as I say, we hosted, it was a Thursday night, earlier in the week, we held a meeting which was addressed by the Speaker of the Malaysian House of Representatives. And he was talking about how they'd attempted to impose a sort of no-smoking ban in the Parliament building in Malaysia. But there was a question about who had the authority to do that. And he ended up consulting Erskine May, going back to British parliamentary conventions and regulations. And if there are those kinds of links, it's in Britain's interest to keep them fresh, to keep them going. Even if the Secretariat has.
So pulling back on that perspective then with the finances,
yeah.
just to end on this possibly then, is this really a sort of meta-narrative of decline? And that this is the square that can't be circled, because the Commonwealth came into being because of British decline, and British decline, which cannot underwrite the Commonwealth, means that it cannot function.
Mm.
So are we talking then about a story where Britain is actually doing decline very well because it's hanging on to these organisations? Or is the fact that it's hanging on to these organisations mean that it's doing decline very badly because it's making it very difficult to, move on?
I think, as I say, I think the main danger is in terms of the sort of the British mentalities, of a failure of clear thinking. And some of the kind of craziness around Brexit and sort of linking Brexit to this supposedly, to the X, we're going to get back with all our friends and this term, our friends in the Commonwealth, our friends around the world. It's proved so destructive for us that what had seemed to me, in earlier years as director, as a sort of harmless quirk of British politics, you can see how it's been turned in on us to really quite destructive effect.
Well, just before we thank Philip, we end on that a rather dramatic note. I just want to say, I've been asked for LSE ideas to say that the next event that they are hosting is on Monday. It's a book launch by Professor Ned Lebel, The Rise and Fall of Political Orders. It's at 6:30 in Fawcett House. And also, just to remind you of the International History's annual lecture, Professor Anne Dighton from Oxford University, and this is a great title, quote, "Breaking up is so very hard to do." What could that possibly be about? Anyway, it's Britain and the EU. It takes place at the Old Theatre at 6:30 p.m. And the date of that is on the website somewhere. But let me please ask you to join me in thanking Professor Murphy.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question.